This is Patty Boyd, and you're listening to Everything Fab Four.
Welcome to Everything Fab Four, a podcast focused on fun and intelligent stories about the Beatles. I'm your host, Ken Womack, music culture columnist for Salon.com and a Beatles scholar and historian. No other band, or popular phenomenon for that matter, has enjoyed the global impact the Beatles have and continue to have more than 50 years later. They are part of our human fabric. They created music that continues to bring people together, and just about everyone has their own Beatles story to tell, some that are surprisingly deep and unexpected. This show seeks to draw those stories out in interesting and insightful ways. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.
My producer, Tyler Chester, gave me two CDs as a gift, and one was Rubber Soul and the other was Abbey Road. And I was like, oh, these are the Beatles. And I was also driving my grandpa's truck. I put in the music, and the first song that came on was Come Together. And everything just kind of stopped and became still. And so my mind was seriously blown. I'll never forget that moment.
Today's guest is Madison Cunningham, a Grammy Award-winning American singer-songwriter. Cunningham grew up in Costa Mesa, California, where she started playing guitar at 7 years old, often performing in church where her father served as pastor. Over the years, she has been influenced by a wide range of artists, from the Beatles, Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan, to Juana Molina, Fiona Apple, and Jeff Buckley. Cunningham made her recording debut in 2014 with the self-released gospel album, Authenticities, which reflected her exploration of faith. But she was only just beginning. In 2017, Cunningham joined the cast of American Public Media's Live From Here. In 2019, she released her breakthrough LP, Who Are You Now?, which earned a Grammy nomination for Best Americana Album. Her 2020 EP, Wednesday, featured cover versions of songs by Tom Waits, Radiohead, and The Beatles, while also earning a Grammy Award nomination for Best Folk Album. In 2022, she released her follow-up LP, Revealer, which enjoyed extensive critical acclaim. Relics, for example, described her guitar riffs as intricate, experimental, and rhythmically dense, adding that perhaps it's her voice, rich in country rock earthiness, yet expressive on a technical level. Maybe it's the vividly painted character portraits that anchor her lyrics. Whatever your entry point is, the California native expertly balances weirdness and warmth. Consequence lauded Cunningham as a master of arranging inimitable indie rock gems and as an incredible guitar player, period. With Revealer, Cunningham earned two more Grammy Award nominations, including Best American Roots Performance for her song, Life According to Rachel, and Best Folk Album, for which she won her first Grammy Award. Welcome, Madison Cunningham. Congratulations on the Grammy win. That is so fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I've been so enjoying the album, which one, Revealer. Is it Revealer or The Revealer?
It's just Revealer.
Nice. And of course, our Beatles fans out there will think Revolver. And
exactly.
And they can do that all they want.
It's very true. I had that sort of, you know, question, reasonable doubt in my head where I was like, I feel like people are going to read it. Someone said Revolver the other day and I was like, oh, no. It's definitely Revealer. But I knew that those comparisons would be drawn and went for it anyway.
Well, there are worse things.
Yeah, for sure.
So what is a Revealer? How do you see the Revealer, the concept? Because, of course, there is no title track called Revealer.
Right. There's actually no lyric across the whole record that even says Revealer. But, you know, Revealer was a title that I've had for like 5 years, and I had wanted, to use it at some point, and it felt like it was aligned with sort of like all of the themes that were happening in the album. And to me, it's like a character that's, you know, neither negative or positive, that's kind of just like unveiling the truth behind everything. And to me, Revealer, or the Revealer, is grief, because I think grief does that very thing, which is kind of illuminate, the truest parts of ourselves, whether we wish it did or didn't. And I, you know, that's kind of that's what the album's kind of laced with, is that idea.
Well, you can definitely hear that. Yeah. That grief is almost kind of a litmus test about a person and their character and how they experience things.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's often really disappointing to see yourself in that light, and you know, sometimes how weak you really are. Or how strong too. You know, I think it can surprise you either way. And but yeah, you know, also I just thought the name sounded really cool.
And it does. And it you know, I'm a university professor, and half of my work is in English literature. And I immediately thought of poetry, right? A revealer is a kind of, I don't know, a shaman or something, but somebody who sees mm-hmm. behind human experience and literally reveals something about it.
Oh, I really like that. I like that a lot.
Well, feel free to steal it. It's there for you.
I will definitely. That is my job. We steal things.
So let's talk about this job of yours. So did you have a musical background? Do you come from a musical family?
I do. Yeah. My grandmother was a fabulous guitar player, really good finger picker. And then kind of trailing down from her, my dad is a guitar player, musician. And then I think that's kind of where I first saw it at play, was in his hands, and you know, it was just always around. And so I apparently was rumored to have kind of started to reach for his guitar when I was about like 3 or 4. Huh. So it was always something that I was like, you know, apparently very interested in. And then by the time I was 7, I really started playing, and you know, bursting my fingers open while trying to get my calluses strong enough to really hold down chords. Sorry, I sound like an AI bot right now. My voice is like apparently going away.
Well,
getting sick or something.
I hope it comes back.
I know, right? We would hope.
So do you have, like, you know, this is such a common question, but here it goes, you know, triteness be damned. Do you remember your earliest guitar?
Oh yeah. I swear to God, it was a baby Taylor, and I don't have any photo proof of this, but I remember it was really, the body was really small. And we don't even have it anymore. I don't know what ended up happening to it, but that was the first guitar that was like bought for me. And then I learned on that, cause it was small enough for my hands. And then we lost track of it. And I remember playing my dad's like Sunburst guitar, and that thing would still look really, really big next to me now. But at that, you know, at 7 or 8, 9 and 10, I started like transitioning to that guitar. I think I just, you know, lost track of the baby Taylor. I have no idea.
Where is that thing?
I don't know. It just joined the other Taylors or something.
Is there a point when you started writing songs, or did you study music at school? Did these sorts of things happen?
Well, this is an interesting piece of the backdrop, which is I was homeschooled. So my education in music was, you know, I had a piano teacher for a little while, and you know, that didn't last for very long. And I kind of just, you know, all of it was really ear training and listening to songs and just kind of being obsessed with guitar. And guitar and writing kind of went hand in hand. And I started when I was, I probably started writing songs when I was like 7 or 8 as well. It just kind of, you know, they went together. Apparently I was very sad at 7 and 8 and had stuff to write about. I don't know. I mean, you don't have to be sad to write songs, but they were very sad. And I will never show them to anybody.
Okay. Well, that was my next question. So I will scratch that one off.
Put that down.
I teach a course on Bruce Springsteen in the spring, aptly enough. And, we were talking about his, he had several lines about how he's attracted to singing songs about the blues, right? And he's not the only one, you know, to craft a line like that. But what is it about sad songs, do you think, that it does seem to exist in our DNA? And Revealer then makes a lot of sense in terms of these stories that we keep coming back to tell.
I think sadness is something that is we're all in tune with more than our own happiness. Like I feel like, you know, happiness is still an elusive idea and what that means and how to find it and how to keep it. But sadness is kind of rooted. It's planted always. It's always, you know, lurking. So I think anytime somebody sings to it, it's just like it strikes and people can relate to that. And you know, it's really hard to write a joyful song well, or in a way that's not just like, you know, made to dance to, or which is, I think, is maybe a missed opportunity. I think there's a way to tap into that, you know, that's not just for clubs or just for dancing or just, you know what I mean? I think, and I'm sure it's been done. I'm not saying that it hasn't, but for me, I feel I'm quite gratified when my songs feel dark. And I talk to my songwriting buddies all the time about this, which is like, how do we also write sad music that doesn't make people want to like kill themselves? Like for real, like there's a lot of music right now that's just like so sad and self-involved and in its own head that, how do we still write music with perspective? If there is any, you know? I guess the answer to that is we all, like, sadness is a common language.
It is, and as your new album suggests, it is wrapped up in loss, and even a kind of nostalgia, I suppose, for the thing we lost. But it's just uncanny, and I guess if we had to look for a happy song, I'd what, Walking on Sunshine or something like that.
Oh, goodness. I mean, Here Comes the Sun. I feel like, you know, that's a beautifully whimsical, happy song. And not to like jump the gun, but I feel like the Beatles probably did that very well.
I would have to agree with you. There are a number of songs that I like to think of as being almost impressionistic, right? Maybe they're not telling you anything in particular. I mean, Here Comes the Sun, the title is saying a lot of it. Or Dear Prudence.
Yeah.
You know, songs that there is this positive energy to it. And maybe that's one of the reasons they're an outlier. So when did you discover this Beatles band? You know, like me, you're not a first generation fan. We discovered them after it was all over.
Right. Well, this is another interesting fact. Like in my background. My parents just didn't, I don't have recollection of them playing a lot of music around the house. And specifically, I remember my dad saying, like, I just don't like the Beatles. And he made a point of saying that. And I was like, well, but who are the Beatles? You know, I never had any context for who that was. So by the time I was graduating high school, I was 17, probably going on 18 that fall. And I was working on my first ever album, and of songs that I had, you know, written when I was like 14, 15, 16, et cetera. And at the end of it was my graduation date. And my producer, Tyler Chester, gave me two CDs as a gift. And one was Rubber Soul and the other was Abbey Road. And I was like, oh, these are the Beatles. And another, you know, important piece to the context was I was deep in my first job, which was I was delivering cookies around Orange County for this business that was taking off. And I was also driving my grandpa's truck because my car was out of commission for some reason. And his truck did not have AC, but it did have a radio and a CD player. So I put in the music, and the first song that came on was Come Together. And everything just kind of stopped and became still because I had heard these songs just probably, you know, out in the wild somewhere, or like over the speakers at a restaurant or whatever. And it kind of was like, you know, the ultimate version of putting the name to the voice. And so my mind was seriously blown. Like, I'll never forget that moment. And what I hadn't realized was that I didn't roll the windows down and all the cookies had melted. but I didn't bother to, I kind of noticed it and thought, it'll be fine, whatever. At least they're on time or whatever. So I gave them to the lady at the farmer's market, and she was so pissed at me that she made me wait in some office for like an hour. And when she came in and she was kind of like, okay, well, what do you have to say for yourself? My actual defense was like, have you ever heard Abbey Road? And she didn't care. But I feel in hindsight, that was a good enough excuse. My 17-year-old brain was all over the dashboard. I was, it really did, change the musical landscape for me.
We'll be back with more from Madison Cunningham after these messages. We're back with more from Everything Fab Four. I had a very similar, you know, some decades before, but a very similar experience discovering them, where they did always exist. They were, yeah, you know, well broken up, et cetera, et cetera. They actually were all four still alive, but sadly barely at that point. But the point is, I had the same kind of feeling where it was like, where have these songs been all my life? But they were always there. And I know I had to have heard them, right? Like you said, it's proliferate. It's in restaurants. It's everywhere.
I do wonder if, you know, even at the time that the songs came out and people were hearing them in real time, if those audiences didn't feel the same way. Because it's like, it feels like they are songs that have just always existed. Cause they're timeless and classic. So it's almost like no matter what time in your life you discover them, it's still relevant, or, you know, almost feels like it way predates the time that you would have found it, no matter when you found it, you know?
Yeah, sure. They exist in this kind of time capsule. And I don't mean that as in dated or what have you. They just exist in this kind of locked space.
Yeah. and untouchable.
Yeah, really. Right. And you know, you brought up the word classic, which I love when it comes to songwriting, but it's real, right? I mean,
yeah.
When you hear a song, like Here Comes the Sun, which is the most streamed Beatles song, always has been. I love that for George Harrison. You know, because he took a lot of crap there for a while. And to be on top like that is pretty meaningful.
Yeah.
And he also had the last number one hit by any of the solo Beatles, Got My Mind Set on You. So way to go, George.
I love the underdog. I love the underdog always.
But the word classic, right? I mean, when you hear a song like one you've covered, In My Life, they had to know when they made that thing in October 1965 that they'd nailed it. That even before they plastered on, you know, George Martin's piano solo, it had to have been a looking glass moment where you finish that and you think, you know, damn, this is better than a lot of our other songs, right? I mean, that's a real thing, right? When we hear music and when you're writing it, you can tell when something's a cut above.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess like if, you know, when you write songs or something, you can tell when something is like, needs work, but has potential. Or when you're like, oh no, I need to buy myself a drink. That's a good song, you know? But the, like, imagine being the Beatles and operating on, you know, within that sort of echelon and being like, I mean, I would imagine they seemed fairly humble, at least some of them. So there was probably still a level of like, they were still fighting for something good. They were still, you know, up against a good song, always trying to find it, you know?
And that's the journey, right, that you're on as a songwriter. You're trying to find that too. So I wonder if you could give our listeners a sense of what your process is like, you know, because it has become, you know, I understand you're not delivering cookies anymore, right? This is the job.
The good news is that was my first and last job outside of music, which is very lucky. Very lucky. And, but also, you know, requires your focus and hard work. And, you know, my process has definitely taken on different shapes. But now, what's kind of fun about it for me is I feel like I understand myself enough to know what will get me from the beginning to the end of a song. And usually I come to the table with an idea and meaning kind of a musical idea, whether it's like a melody or a guitar thing or a progression or a beat or something. And from there, I usually kind of finish the whole arrangement. Like I know where the verse is and where the chorus is and where it's all kind of headed. And then after that, the melody and lyrics kind of emerge from me just throwing eggs at the wall and being like, which one sticks. And that's usually like how the words and the concept will form. There's only a few times where I've come to the, you know, I've come with a concept first. Usually that makes itself clear somewhere down the line after the music. And that, you know, that has changed. Sometimes lyrics will come first, or there's like a lyric idea that I jot down and I know that it'll go somewhere at some point. But you know, as time has gone on, it's that sort of pattern of writing and finishing a song has pretty much remained pretty religious.
It's interesting how everyone has their own process, whether it's, you know, writing a book or a story or a song, that, you know, is integrally yours. And you can hear about how other people write songs. And it's very interesting when we learn about how other people approach their craft. But it's true, right? There's almost no getting around what it takes for you to write a song, right? Whereas, you know, you can hear about how Lennon and McCartney wrote songs eyeball to eyeball, or however they used to describe it. But that doesn't necessarily help you, right?
Exactly. Well, it's like diets, you know? It's like so many people fall into bad diets because they want somebody to tell them exactly how to lose weight. But we kind of always forget to factor in that everybody responds to, you know, food or whatever, or exercise completely differently. And the most annoying part about seeing real change is like going on your own adventure and seeing like what will actually work for you. And I think songwriting is the same way. It's like, yeah, you exactly like you just said, you can, you know, read books, you know, about how all the greats have done it. But ultimately, you have to know what really, you know, brings it out of you. And I believe in, you know, my process does, like I said, look very similar every time, but I do believe in shaking up the process and finding, you know, going somewhere or, you know, trying to, you know, pick up a new instrument that doesn't really make a lot of sense to you and try and write from there. Or, 'cause you truly never know what will metabolize into something that, you know, is inspiring to you.
So you must then, when you're seeking inspiration, go to some of your touchstones. I mentioned, you know, in my life before, and I've watched, and I encourage our listeners to do this, the beautiful rendition, and it's a video, in fact, on YouTube. Folks can see where you're performing in a kind of duet with, is it Mike Viola?
Mike Viola, yeah.
I mean, it's just gorgeous, and it's mostly the In My Life we know and love, but it's the little things, isn't it, that make a cover version so interesting. Can you tell us about your approach to that song?
Yeah, that sort of version came together really quick because Mike and I actually were playing a show together and we wanted to find something to sing. And we both just were like, what if we should do something about the Beatles? And then I threw that one out and we kind of just, because we had so little time, we stuck to the pretty much the basic structure. And then we changed some slight melodic things to work with the harmonies we were building. And afterwards it went really well. And so we ended up just like making a little video in his living room. It was like, there was not a ton of thought, honestly, that went into it besides, you know, making sure that the harmonies were cool. And it's funny because like you said, it's different enough because I can tell when a friend of mine covered our version of it at a show and she didn't know I was there and I was watching it. And I thought, I think that is Mike and I's version just because of the slight variation and melody that she sang. And afterwards I asked her and she was like, oh yeah, totally. That was you and Mike's version, which is just funny, which I think that's like, if you're going to have the opportunity to redo a classic, it's probably always good to do something a little different.
You bet. And there were great little touches. For example, the way he picks out the piano solo, he doesn't do it exactly the same. He finds a few similarities and has a little fun with it, you know, so it's not too pretentious. And then you're wonderful. And I think this is what you were alluding to, your way of singing the melody a couple of times where you would sort of take a little downward trip in your vocal. That was very cool.
Oh, that's cool. I'm glad you liked or noticed that. That's cool.
Yeah. And well, speaking then of cover versions, Radiohead.
Mm.
You know, for a person who does what I guess folks would say, you do a lot of singer-songwriter folk music, etc., Radiohead is, to me, just vastly refreshing. So tell me about your Radiohead experiences.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm completely obsessed with Radiohead, and I wanted to cover something of theirs, and I've always loved that song. A friend actually suggested that I do it, and again, it was one of those things that just kind of came together quickly without much thought. And I think that also is a testament to the songwriting, because it was easy enough to play and memorable and beautiful. And I think in the hands of, you know, anybody that could hold a tune, that song would stand. And you know, Thom Yorke is a genius, because to me, they are the modern day Beatles, because they did, you know, they changed the musical landscape truly in so many different ways for, you know, so many artists from, you know, and across different genres. And of course they're British also, that helps in my comparison. But yeah, they're my absolute favorite band, no question.
It is, and they strive to be different, right? They, every time they do something new, they're trying to create something different, which is, that's Beatles 101 right there. I love the way you sing No Surprises. I found myself, and you know, I've heard Radiohead and Thom Yorke version many, many times, but I found myself hearing the words when you sang it.
Hmm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I started to realize more for the first time, and maybe I should be a better listener. I apologize, Radiohead, but I found myself really understanding what it was about in your hands better than in theirs.
Oh, wow.
It too is a kind of sad song, isn't it?
Oh, it's devastating. Those lyrics are unbelievable. Heart that's full up like a landfill, a job that slowly kills you, bruises that won't heal. That's so good. That's devastating. He's also like the king of writing sad songs.
Oh my gosh, right.
I mean, yeah, like the real darkness kind of sad tunes. But I love it. Again, it's so deeply speaks to me, and it makes me happy. That's my happy dance music, is Radiohead.
You know,
I don't know what that says about me, but
well, I think it, unfortunately, it's about me too, and I think many others. That verse actually gets much more damning, right? You look so tired, unhappy, bring down the government. They don't speak for us. It takes a quiet life, a handshake of carbon monoxide.
I know, it's fucking insane. And all, you know, my partner and I have talked a lot about like what the song means, and what's so great about it is it's so three-dimensional, because to him, he was like, oh, that's like about somebody wasting away in a cubicle. And to me, I was like, I actually think he's speaking to his own fame and his own life. Like, I think he's speaking to his own job that he probably loves, but it's also like slowly chipping away at him, and he would love to take a quiet life. Do you know what I mean? But again, I think the lyrics are so broad and ambiguously beautiful, yet like very specifically general, in which, you know, it allows people to take, you know, insert their own experiences into it.
Right. And I read a handshake of carbon monoxide. I mean, I don't know if the person's in a cubicle or if they're in their garage with the door down, you know, and
yeah,
they're contemplating suicide. It's just, he knows how to get to the darkness, Thom Yorke.
He surely does. And he lives there, which is, you know, he's a voice for a lot of people. And that's, I feel like that's when you know you've like really done your job as a songwriter.
You know, when you thinking about OK Computer, right? And karma police, you know, when will the karma police come for you? It's
oh,
that's not necessarily sad so much as hopeful, you know, in that kind of sardonic
like justice way.
Yeah.
He's also really good at, this is another emotion that not, you know, is hard to do well. It's like anger. He's good at sounding really pissed off. And I believe that. And that, and I absolutely need that. I need to feel justified in my, you know, angst.
Yeah, he's not faking.
No. And he's not doing it for anybody. That's just so clear. It's been so clear from the beginning. And I look to that.
So when you're working on a new album and you're contemplating the next thing, how does a project like that emerge? You know, are you in a situation like the Beatles where George Martin is saying, by the way, you know, you need to have an album next month? How do the rhythms of that process take place for you?
Well, my George Martin would be probably my label. you know, and they're not like, they don't make any demands. There's kind of this like arbitrary timeline that we all kind of operate under, and it usually aligns with my own hopes of when a, you know, new music will come out. But you know, for me, it's music first always. Deadlines are just a means to get me there. And right now that the album's been out for, you know, more than 6 months, probably 7 or 8 now, I'm writing again and just trying to find my creative center. And it's always a little horrifying at the beginning. I'm always just, you know, I, no matter what, always feel a little bit rusty and afraid that I'm not gonna be able to do it again. And it's that's the most exciting part, is kind of coming through the other side of that fear, is finding songs again. And I love that more than anything. I think I love that more than touring, more than recording. It's like actually finding it and feeling like, oh, this is good. I found something good. And I think that only happens by continuing to just be boneheaded about it and try again and believe. It's like songwriting is being the ultimate optimist. It's you are constantly, you know, having to deny yourself and hope that there's something better underneath all of yourself. Hope that there's something in there, basically. But really, like all the best songwriters, it's like when they find a good lyric, it's always earned. Always earned. Leonard Cohen always said, like, I'm lucky if I write one good lyric a week or something like that. And I always think about that. It's not, you know, it's easy to sort of take the cop out of like, oh, well, they're just talented and they just, you know, they just vacation most of the year. And then when they want to write a song or an album, they write it in a whole week. And it's like, that's just not true. It's, you know, it usually just takes a lot of time.
That makes me think of Paul McCartney's effortless bass, you know, parts that he would spend 8 or 9 hours recording.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's the, you know, the ultimate form of irony. It's like the most effortless things take so much effort. And, you know, that's kind of the deal.
Everything Fab 4 is presented by Salon.com, the premier news, politics, innovation, and arts website. For more information, visit everythingfab4.com, where you can learn more about our podcast and my latest Beatles-related books, including John Lennon 1980, The Last Days in the Life, and a forthcoming biography about beloved Beatles roadie Mal Evans. The Everything Fab 4 theme song, Seize the Day, is provided courtesy of Black Rabbit, the high-octane Beatles cover band and innovative psychedelic rock project from Rockaway Beach, Queens in New York City. Like what you heard today on Everything Fab 4? Be sure to subscribe, give us a rating, and recommend the show to your friends. Plus, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at EF4 Podcast. Distributed by Salon, Everything Fab 4 is a Wonderwall production. Remember, it's a Beatles world, and everyone has a story.